recording. And is this thing running? Yeah, okay, great. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is GiveWell's top charities. Basically, these are the best giving opportunities we know of for individual donors today. And the basic way we define top charities is they're combining evidence of effectiveness with excellent bang for the buck or cost effectiveness. In other words, for every dollar you spend, you're doing a lot of good in terms of saving lives or improving lives. And there's strong evidence behind that idea that the programs you're supporting and the charities you're supporting have track records behind them. They have impact evidence behind them. That's what we mean by a top charity. And we've, you know, spent the last 7 years or so trying to identify charities like that to give people a very tangible place to give and feel like you're doing as much good as is kind of possible to do with the information we have, which is obviously very limited. The basic way we go about finding top charities has evolved over the years somewhat, but the fundamental idea is to look for programs that have strong evidence behind them. So there's a lot of different things that charities do and that governments do to try to improve people's lives. A lot of them are kind of untested. A lot of them are only guessing at what impact they have. But there are some programs, especially when it comes to global health, where there is strong evidence, strong studies, and you can say not only is there good reason to believe that this program really does improve people's lives in a significant way, but it's also doing a lot for the money. And so it's those two criteria that lead us to identify programs, which you'll hear about, like insecticide-treated bed nets for preventing malaria, like treating children for intestinal parasites, or in some cases something simpler like handing out money to people who have very little money. But all of these things have kind of a strong evidence base, and there's good reason to think that we know something about their impact on people's lives, and that the impact is pretty big for the money you're spending. And the focus here is very much on the developing world, because we've worked on both developing world and U.S. programs over the years and have just ended up focusing on the developing world because we believe that poverty there is much more severe, and as a result, the opportunities to help people with money are much greater. There's much more basic needs that are lacking, and you can do a lot more with a little bit of cash. That's our basic process. That's our basic criteria. So our top charities, they're all charities that we've recommended in the past, but for all of them, there are some significant new developments. And also for all of them, we had to take a really close look this year at how much money we think they can productively take in. One of the big things that we care about a lot at GiveWell is what we call room for more funding. And that is, you know, the idea that there may be a great charity, but they may have all the funding they can use to do their best activities. We really care about where that next dollar goes. And that's a huge focus of our investigations. So we paid a lot of attention to that this year because I think a lot of our top charities, we may be moving them about as much money as they can productively handle, and we've been sure to calibrate our recommendations to that. So the charities themselves, probably the most familiar one is Against Malaria Foundation, or AMF. They distribute insecticide-treated bed nets, which kill mosquitoes and help prevent malaria. There's been studies associating these with reductions in child mortality and other health benefits. We recommended AMF as our top charity for a couple of years, moved them something in the range of $10 million total, and then a couple of years went by where they kind of just, that money didn't go out the door. They didn't sign new distributions to distribute bed nets. And I think a major factor in that is that AMF, compared to other bed net organizations, has high standards for data. They want proof that the bed nets were delivered. They want data on whether people are still using the bed nets a while after they get them. And the whole thing, they want the whole thing documented. And this is something that we are very much in support of and think is a great thing, but it can cause it to be difficult with negotiation because you're working with a government in Africa is where AMF works, and you're saying, well, we'll provide you bed nets, but we want this kind of above and beyond data reporting, and we want it to be public. So that creates challenges, and a couple of years went by where AMF wasn't getting money out the door, and we suspended their top charity recommendation, not because we think they're bad, but because we said, look, they haven't gotten money out the door in a substantial way in a couple of years. let's wait until they do before recommending that more money goes there. This year they did. They signed a couple more distributions with some new distribution partners, and they committed a total of about $8.4 million to distributions that will take place in the next couple of years. They committed $8.4 million. They have about $6.8 million left. So that was, you know, substantial. And we have returned them to the list for that reason. There's no obvious way to say how much more money they could take in this year. Our basic thinking is if they took in $10 million more, they would then have twice as much on hand as the total they've committed to date, which I think is a lot. And we would like them to have a lot because we'd like to be helping them grow and helping them get bigger. But to us, that's probably where we'd feel good seeing the donations kind of stop coming in. And then Good Ventures, which is a major foundation that we work with and has taken a lot of our recommendations, has already committed $5 million to them. So basically, we are hoping to get them another $5 million this giving season. And just to keep in mind with AMF, I mean, I think they're a great, it's a great organization, and they hold BedNet distributions to a high standard, which we think is great. There is a limited track record here. They used to do very small distributions, and now they do big distributions, but there's only a couple of those that have progressed far enough that we really know how they're going, and they're both in the same area with the same partner. So I think it is good to get them more money and see them grow. I don't think we want to do that without limit. Then next top charities, there are two charities that both work on what we call deworming, which is also treating children for intestinal parasites, such as hookworm and schistosomiasis, which is a great name. These parasites are very common. So in a lot of areas of Africa, like over half the children in an entire country will be infected with one of these parasites. They're very easy to treat. They're very cheap to treat. It's like in the range of 50 cents a year to treat children for these worms, maybe a dollar a year. They're also, however, often completely without symptoms, and it's not really clear what you get by treating the worms. So we've been going on limited evidence, and prior to this year, we would have said the best thing we had to go on was a single study in which they randomly treated some children for worms and not others. They found that attendance improved in school among the children who were treated, and then many years later, earnings were higher as well. That was really impressive. If you believe you can get that kind of effect for only 50 cents a year per child, I think we always had issues with that study because, you know, among other things, it took place in the middle of El Nino, and so worm infections were, like, greatly elevated and were extremely high, and so there's a question of how much that generalizes. This year, a new study came out looking at a randomized deworming program in a nearby area that may have been affected by El Nino, but probably not as much, and found cognitive test improvements from deworming. So this was actually very reassuring to us, and although both studies have their problems and some of the problems overlap, we definitely increased our confidence that deworming really is a great intervention. We estimate that it's about as good as distributing bed nets when we do our calculations, although they're obviously very difficult to compare because one saves lives and the other is mostly having kind of these intangible effects on perhaps health or earning capacity. And so, you know, but overall, we think this is an excellent intervention. There's two charities on our list that work on it. One of them is called Deworm the World Initiative. And the main thing I have to say about them is that they don't have a ton of room for more funding this year. So I think they're a great organization. They don't carry out deworming themselves. They work with governments, and they try to advocate for it, and they try to help the process along. We've been pretty convinced that they have actually gotten the process to move along in a lot of cases. But at this point, they actually have interest from a lot of major funders, which is more the case this year than last year. And so when they're asking for money, it's mostly unrestricted funds to fill in the gaps. Some of that is like operational research to, you know, to help them study their own programs and see how they work. But we're only talking about $1.3 million over the next 2 years. And much of that is not for core activities. And Good Ventures has given them $250,000. So there's like $1 million remaining over 2 years that we're hoping to see them get. And we're kind of recommending a target of $500,000 this giving season. Other deworming organization is Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, or SCI. This is a group we've always struggled with because they work on a great intervention. They're well-respected. They're run by academics. They've been around for a long time. They've moved a lot of money. but we have had a lot of trouble communicating with them. We still have very little sense of how they've spent their unrestricted funds. And we've also had major problems with their evaluation. So they've had these research reports that for years we thought were evidence that their programs are actually working and that they're getting governments to roll out these deworming programs. And last year we discovered major problems in these studies that we felt we should have known about before that really make us see these studies as not, at least some of these studies we no longer believe are indicating much to us at all. And so it's that tension that has made us always a little bit unsure what to do with SCI, but we have been following them for a long time. We've looked at them really carefully, and we haven't found red flags. We think this is a pretty straightforward program. We think they're getting it to work, and we think they can absorb about $7 million over the next year. However, when you take out the grants that we already know about from other sources, including Good Ventures, we think there's about $1 million left that we would like to see them raise this year. And then the final top charity, and then I'll take questions, is GiveDirectly. GiveDirectly is very different from the others. GiveDirectly is a pretty new organization, and what they do is for every dollar you give, they try to get 90 cents directly into the hands of very low-income people, like in Kenya and Uganda, and it's with no strings attached. So they use a mobile money system, and it's basically these lump sum cash payments. They're not providing services. They're not buying health equipment. And this is obviously, some people think this is the greatest thing in the world. Some people think it's very controversial and would be more comfortable with health. For our part, we think this is a pretty good intervention. And it's actually been a lot of studies on it, partly because people are skeptical about it. They ran a randomized study on themselves a year ago. They were the first charity we knew of who had done that. And it had very encouraging results. So we don't think cash transfers are the best intervention. We actually think deworming and bed nets do more good per dollar. But we do think that unconditional cash transfers are really, really good. And we think GiveDirectly is a great organization. So when we first recommended them, they were young. They didn't have a track record, and we didn't have that much to go on. But now they've been scaling up fast. They had an encouraging study of themselves. Last year, they took in $17 million and got $13 million out the door. That was a big growth. And this year, they're saying $40 million, and we think that's probably true, that they could do that. And by the way, there's an event on Monday night at NYU with the GiveDirectly co-founders that we tweeted about today, if anyone wants to check that out, because they're a very interesting organization. The main bad news for GiveDirectly, I mean, most of the news from them has been good. The main bad news is just that their competition has gotten stronger. I think our estimate of how good deworming is more this year than last year. AMF is back in the picture with the bed nets. And so where last year we had GiveDirectly, you know, really kind of at the top of the list and Give All Staff for All Giving there, this year it's a tougher call. I think they're the best organization of the crop in terms of execution, in terms of room for funding, in terms of consistently monitoring how things are going and reporting on it so that they can find any problems. But we do estimate that deworming and bed nets probably accomplish more good than cash transfers by a significant amount, like a factor of 5 to 10. So this year, we're recommending $1 million. We're targeting $1 million this giving season from individuals to give directly. So those are our top charities. I'm going to take questions now, and then I'll talk about the standouts. And also, I think, according to my phone, there's someone trying to get in. Okay. Well, anyway. Tom.
So just for disclosure, I'm on the Give Well board, so I'm on Team Give Well. But it would be helpful maybe to give people a little bit of context about how these compare to kind of the broader universe of charities and, you know, international versus domestic. I mean, you mentioned earlier that there's more bang for the buck on international versus domestic, but I think if you just, you know, if people aren't as familiar with Give Well's work, just hear what you said, you're hearing sort of a lot of pros and cons, maybe wondering why do these stand out relative to that?
Sure. So the question is, why do these charities stand out relative to the pack, and how do they compare to domestic charities? I mean, for each of these charities, I can say they focus on a program. The program has really, you know, unusually strong evidence behind it. So even those two kind of semi-problematic studies of deworming, I mean, those are semi-problematic. I mean, most evidence of what charities do is extremely problematic or non-existent. And so I would say, you know, these charities all focus on programs with very strong evidence of impact, and they do an amazing amount of good per dollar. So even GiveDirectly, I mean, I think of it as kind of like a 100x multiplier on your money, because you're giving to people whose incomes are, you know, 1/100th of the median income in America, and the amount they're able to do with that. I mean, I think so, in some cases people are using it to buy livestock, which is probably something you've heard of a charity doing, but they're doing it when it makes sense for them. In other cases, they might replace their straw roof with a metal roof and save time and expense for, you know, 10 years on repairing the roof and not having it leak. So, you know, your money can go really far with these interventions, and the evidence is really strong that it can do so. And I think these are basic, you know, almost the only charities we found that we can say that about. And then within that small universe of charities that I can say that about, there's some that we've also really checked out the organization itself, and that's these organizations. So they all, you know, give us all about disclosing the good and the bad and not, you know, not turning everything into a sugar-coated story. And that's why with all of these, there's warts, there's doubts, there's risks, there's confusions. But absolutely, I mean, these are the charities that I would give to if I was trying to help people a lot with every dollar that I gave. Yep.
So I thought the deworming the growth model concerns were pretty good, as long as you're careful about generalizability concerns. But so there's a meta-analysis like 2 years ago showing that deworming has like not very good effects and the kind of impact that school attendance is supposed to be a proxy for.
Yeah.
So when you're weighing evidence from like different studies of kind of degree, how do you choose what to look for weight to?
Yeah. So how do we choose which studies to put weight on? And in particular, how do we view the kind of what one might call the great deworming debate if one reads different news than most people, which is, you know, the Cochrane collaboration, which is a very well-respected and we find them incredibly useful group that, you know, they tend to review a lot of evidence on medical interventions and come out with a bottom line. And their bottom line on deworming was it's not very impressive. There's really no evidence that deworming helps people at all. So, I mean, first I'll answer the general question. The general question is, we believe that in these areas, these are kind of, you know, these are very difficult fields to do measurements in. You can't do lab experiments. You're doing kind of experiments on people, and they're taking place over many years. We have not found a formulaic way or a single reliable source that's just going to give us the answer on how good the evidence is. And what a lot of what we do at GiveWell and a lot of the value that we believe we bring is just looking really hard at everything, understanding exactly what the researchers did, why you might think this was a good idea, what problems you might see with the study, and writing up everything in kind of exhaustive detail. And so, you know, you can go to our website and read our deworming page, and it will walk through the studies that we don't think are good, why we don't think they're good, the studies that we do think are good, why we do think they're good. And, you know, really all we're trying to do is just work really hard at it and be really thoughtful and not rely on some authority or some formula, but rather just understand everything ourselves and use our own judgment. I think for these kinds of studies, that's exactly the right way to do it, because a lot of the issues are more qualitative, like the fact that El Nino happened. How you deal with that is a judgment call, and it doesn't generally take a lot of technical expertise to understand these studies. What it does take is kind of like patience and detail. So in the case of deworming, you know, my take on this debate is that the Cochrane collaboration does a good job when there are a lot of studies, and the studies were all done in similar ways with similar measurements, similar outcomes, and then Cochrane can kind of apply criteria, aggregate them, compare them, and say, here's the bottom line. That is not the case with deworming. With deworming, there's a lot of short-term studies, and then there was one, and now there's two long-term studies. And I think that just doesn't fit Cochrane's approach. So, you know, basically what I would say with deworming is, like, short-term studies show almost nothing. Long-term studies show much more impressive effects. And I don't think that Cochrane really did anything to undermine that. Also, it does give me doubt. And the Cochrane studies, you know, the Cochrane point we take, which is that there are a lot of short-term studies and they don't show very much. And that should make you question, hey, does this actually make sense? Or is there something weird going on with those two studies? I think there's a really good chance that there's something weird going on with those two studies. And the case for deworming is that, you know, maybe those studies are valid and maybe they aren't. The intervention is really cheap. The effects are really impressive. And at the probability we're assigning that those studies are legit, it comes out as a really good deal in probabilistic terms.
It's also the case that in the Cochrane review that did not look at studies that included schistosomiasis treatment, which is mostly what SCI does. Deworm the World only does soil-transmitted helminth treatment, which the Cochrane review was focused on. But the two longer-term studies that Holden mentioned and SCI's work in general treats both kinds of worms, and generally schistosomiasis is thought to be a worse disease.
The newer study does not look at schisto. It's only the soil transmitted, but otherwise, that's right. This is kind of the point, is like Cochrane was looking for studies that all did the same thing. So they're you know, very focused on one kind of worm, and then there's another kind of worm, and so that's an example of the kind of stuff that we spend a lot of time debating. Yeah, Ian?
I've heard that next year might be an El Nino year.
Uh-huh.
Is that going to change your thoughts on the cost effectiveness of donations to deworming in this given cycle?
Question is, next year might be an El Nino year. Would that change our recommendations? I've never considered that before. Good question. Maybe. I guess I will note it down. I mean, one thing is that the studies we're talking about not only took place in the middle of El Nino, but also took place in areas that were, like, especially good areas to get flooded. So it was just kind of this perfect storm, which tends to be the case with these studies. People want, you know, people are studying something, they want to know if their program works. They don't want the study to fall apart just because they didn't, you know, like, oh, there didn't turn out to be any worms or something. So they tend to just, like, find the perfect circumstances to carry out their study, and they carry it out perfectly. And, like, with the bed nets, I think they, you know, a lot of the studies, they would, like, wake people up at 3 a.m. to make sure the nets were hanging. So, I mean, a lot of times you have to use a lot of judgment deciding how the study applies. And I think, yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point about El Nino. I think if it is an El Nino year, I'm sure we will put a lot of thought into how exactly that should affect our estimates. Yep.
So one thing I've been wondering a lot about recently is kind of the effects that people can't really measure. Because people often measure individualist effects, how a certain intervention affects somebody's income. But a lot of people have raised concerns about the effects that aid can have on communities and nations generally, and if those could possibly counteract any positive effects that would apply to individuals. And I was wondering how people kind of tries to cope with those concerns.
Sure. So GiveWell tends to look at evidence on, you know, the impact that a program has on individuals. And what? That's what I'm doing. Oh, yeah. I'm trying to repeat the question. So the question is starting with a statement, and then there's going to be a semicolon. GiveWell tends to look at evidence on how programs affect individuals, and the question is that canceled out by the program's effect on the countries at large? And in particular, there's some people out there who say, you know, aid is making countries dependent, it is stopping them from developing, etc. So, I mean, a couple of things on this point. I mean, one, we are pretty familiar with the literature on the big picture impacts of aid. I will say that it's, like, pretty inconclusive, and a general fact is that it's hard to say things about the effect of a program on individuals. It's, like, very next to impossible to say things about the effect of a program on countries. I will say that I don't see any good reason to think that aid is hurting countries more than it's helping them. I don't think that's something that anyone's made, like, good arguments for. And I actually think there's really strong arguments going the other direction, that we've seen a lot of, you know, decreases in child mortality and other improvements that look like you should attribute them to aid, and just, you know, the arguments that aid hurts, I mean, there are arguments, but I don't think they're very strong, and they're not very empirically supported. So, you know, that's my opinion. There's not enough evidence here for opinion to be irrelevant, so if you're worried about that, then I think that is something to consider in deciding where to give, but I think it's going to be an issue for most charities. Another interesting comment on this is that GiveDirectly is trying to take this on in an unusual way. So right now, they're doing something that I think is pretty cool. They're running, like, a really, really massive randomized study that they're randomizing at. It's like, I don't even think, is it the village level or is it some bigger unit than that?
I'm
you don't
not
know.
Sure, no.
Yeah. They're randomizing at a large unit. So instead of saying this person gets cash, that person doesn't, they're saying something much more like this village gets cash, that village doesn't.
It's per village. And some of the people in the village, some of the people don't get it. And then they look at the effects of people in the village who get money, people don't get money, and then
the villages versus the other villages, right? So they're trying to do an actual village level study and try and capture some of those macro effects. It still doesn't tell you about the effects on a country, but I still think that's a very cool thing to be doing and pretty interesting. Yeah, Bill.
I don't remember the exact numbers you quoted on each charity about sort of target.
Yep.
You know, let's say it's four charities and target one is $3 million, and the other are $1 million each.
Uh-huh.
Is that an explicit recommendation to say for somebody who's got a giving pie of a certain amount that it should be 50% to charity A, and then a third to the others? And then you also said something about, I think, that malaria nets are maybe 5 times more effective than give directly.
Yeah.
So is that ratio implicit in this asset allocation that you kind of put forth?
Sure.
And are you putting it forth as an asset allocation, or you're just kind of fudging it so people can,
draw their own conclusions? Yeah, so I'd phrase this question as how... On what basis did we come up with our funding targets, the numbers I said we want each charity to get? That's kind of part A. Part B is, did we incorporate our cost effectiveness estimates into that? And part C is, what are we telling individuals to do about this? Are we telling them to give in the ratio we recommend? So I'll take them in turn, because that's what I think is easiest to do. Part A, how did we come up with these targets? You know, this was a lot of discussion. What we did was we estimated how much money we think we're going to... We call it moving money, how much money we're going to influence this year. And basically what we tried to do this year is we said, first off, we would like all top charities to get some significant amount of money, because we think that matters a lot for incentives and for signaling and for kind of the future of GiveWell's ability to follow these groups and also to influence other groups and to make it worth their while to participate in our process. So that's where we said, you know, we'd like to see each one receive at least $1 million. And also, I think I hopefully made it pretty clear going through the strengths and weaknesses here that I don't think there's any clear cut, you know, I think a reasonable person could really argue for any of the four. If I didn't think that, I don't think we necessarily would have gone for this minimum for each, but I do think that, and I think it's a hard choice. Next thing we did is we said, you know, 5 to 10x more cost effective than cash transfers is an awful lot. We don't fully believe that number. It's the best number we could come up with. We made a giant spreadsheet and we posted it online, and you know, we all argued about it a lot. But I mean, it's not a number that we really have a lot of confidence in at all. And we're very aware of that, and we don't want to put too much weight on, you know, these kind of spreadsheets when we have a lot of other data. So how do you feel when you kind of have this process that says, you know, give directly is much worse, but then you also have noticed that give directly is much better in a lot of other ways, like it has done a better job moving money out the door, following up on it, reporting, producing new information. So that is a tough one. I think in past years when the multiplier has been lower than 5 to 10, we've said ultimately we think GiveDirectly is just as good a choice. This year, with the multiplier at 5 to 10 and with us thinking that we really did the best we could with those calcs, we are saying that we prefer to move money to other charities before GiveDirectly. And so basically what we did is we said, first start off with $1 million for each charity, then how much can we get each charity before it starts to run out of room? And once we did that, we were kind of out. We had hit the total number we projected. Finally, what do we want people to do with these numbers? We think everyone should do what they want. I mean, for sure. And we're trying to put the information out there so they can make their own decisions. If someone wants to kind of do the full GiveWell recommended donation action, yes, we would recommend giving in that ratio, largely because we think saying that to everyone is probably the thing that's most likely to result in that allocation. That's something we've done in years past. It's actually worked pretty well because a lot of people do want to do exactly that. And so then you end up with the allocation you're targeting. But, you know, we can't control what people do, and we're not going to end up with the exact allocation. We're just trying to get close to it.
And practically, if someone gives to GiveWell and says, re-grant at your discretion, we will use that allocation.
That's right.
In the near future.
Yep.
So you mentioned with basically all the charities except for GiveDirectly that it sounded to me like you wish they would do kind of more or better research as to the effect of their own actions. Have you thought about maybe past the room for more funding that you identified, restricted funding to kind of force them to do better, more reliable research on the impact of their actions? And
sure.
I have SEI in
particular. Sure. So has GiveWell kind of thought about restricting money and kind of forcing charities to do things more as we would? Our general model is not to do that. Our basic thing is to say where we would give, say why, and try to create incentives, and try to create sort of, you know, information for charities about what is going to get them a good recommendation and what isn't. But that is a different thing from restricting money. So I think this way we leave them with the freedom to make their decisions and spend their money how they're going to spend it and take that into account. That's the quick answer. I mean, just to clarify a couple things, the rant, doing a, there's like kind of two kinds of evidence you could collect about a program. One of them is you really want to know if this program helps people at all. And so you kind of, you know, the gold standard is a randomized study where you randomly give the program to some people, not to others, and you see if some people do better than others. There's another thing where, like, you already have a program that has some evidence behind it, and you're just trying to do everyday keeping up on, like, how are things going? Is this program still running kind of normally? And you're not randomizing anything at that point. Your data is going to look more like how many kids did we deworm instead of, you know, what happened to people's earnings. So it's important to distinguish between those. Give Directly is the only one who's done a randomized study of their own program, but BedNets and Deworming have had independent academics doing randomized studies of them, you know, a bunch of times, and it's debatable whether we really need more at this point. And then there's the monitoring point, where I also think Give Directly is the strongest on collecting information, like, did the cash get into the right people's hands? Were there problems? Were there any reports of trouble? But AMF is also very strong on that, I think. And that's a lot of what actually makes things challenging for them, is they're very determined to do that. And I think SCI, I don't know, what would you say about SCI on that? There's been a lot of confusion, so.
So they've collected some, I would say that their future plans are probably stronger than their past track record. And so we'll see if that pans out. But basically they are trying to collect information both on prevalence and intensity, so whether children are actually being cured of the worms that they are being treated for, as well as coverage rates. So whether pills are getting, or whether children say that they received the pills that they were supposed to receive. And so we've seen our first few coverage studies, and so we're supposed to see a lot more of that in the future. So I think the question of whether, you know, giving them more money or giving them money in a certain way to do more of those studies would really change their behavior is pretty debatable, because I think they're already saying that they're going to have that behavior in the future. And whether or not we find those studies credible, I think is would be much harder to restrict money for. And so it's more a question of whether we think that they can run high-quality studies, and we've seen some evidence of that. And whether we're going to be able to see the data that they collect, because I think they have some challenges with getting that data to us based on their own restrictions, countries' restrictions, and just sort of implementation challenges, whether they actually are able to collect the data that they plan to. So I think the intention is there, and the track record is not quite there as to their monitoring.
Other questions? I take a couple more, and then we'll talk about our standouts, but I'll still be able to take questions after that. Yep.
Any thoughts about these organizations' room for more funding in future years, and how it's going to scale, and A, what the limiting factors are likely to be, and B, is there any way for GiveWell to help with that?
Yeah. Do we have thoughts on room for more funding in future years, and how that's likely to change? So I expect it to be very dynamic. I don't really think that we have the answers now. What we're trying to do is, I think the way we're trying to help them is basically by closing their funding gaps now and getting them money now, because, you know, there's this relationship that GiveWell itself has seen between money and capacity, where, you know, money helps build capacity to then take in more money. With AMF's a good example. I mean, we're trying to get them to a level where they can do more than they've ever done before, but not too much more. And then we'll come back in a year, and maybe they'll still be sitting on all that money, and maybe they'll have gotten it all out the door, and that will definitely make a difference to what we do next. Yep.
So I noticed all the top charities are all direct services. Do you have advocacy organizations? And it's also, so much of this is research based, but for advocacy organizations, it's very difficult to sometimes measure your effectiveness. So Do you have advice for advocacy organizations to be more effective in their energy?
Yeah. So. Do we look at advocacy organizations or just direct service organizations? Some of these organizations do a fair amount of advocacy, and are, like, I would say Deworm the World is, like, part, you know, is well described as an advocacy / technical assistance organization. We do have this criterion for this area that the charity's focus program is something that's evidence supported. So that is very different. You know, they're advocating for deworming, which is itself evidence based, is something very different from, like, advocating for better healthcare policy in the US. We do not evaluate those kind of groups for this particular arm of GiveWell. This is a, you know, an arm that tries to focus on having really tangible giving opportunities that we can understand extremely well. If you do want to hear our thoughts on advocacy, stay for the next session, because that's what we do at Open Philanthropy Project, or that's part of what we do. Yep.
So I was wondering your money move projections for this year, like how they compare with previous years and future years, and if you think, it seems like you're kind of running up against how much money the organizations you really think are effective can handle.
Yeah.
And especially if you feel their funding needs this year, does this restrict your plans for, you know, having more people give to advertising? Do you imagine GiveWell growing, and where is the money going to go if it grows?
Right. So how do we, you know, are we running up against the limit of charities to absorb the money we're moving? I mean, this is not the first time we've been bumping up against that limit, and I think things change a lot from year to year. So in past years, you know, we would have said GiveDirectly is great, but they're so young, we don't want to move them $40 million. I mean, this year would be fine to move them $40 million, though we expect 10 from other sources, and you know, so maybe 20 million would be fine, and that's more than we can move. Actually, I think this year is, you know, again, that's a complicated relationship because charities mature and our research process finds new charities. And so we do increase our ability to move money as we increase money moved. But yeah, it can be hard for the two to keep up with each other. I think this year is some of the best position we've been in a long time. Because even if we move, you know, three times as much money as we're expecting, GiveDirectly could absorb all that residual, no problem. And even some of these other ones, I mean, it'd be okay if they had more money. It might just take them a while to spend it. So I think that's a lot better than it's been. And I think we will, you know, we will continue to see these groups grow, and we have some future top charities on the list, hopefully. So I you know, I hope we'll be able to do it, but I have no guarantee of this. And obviously, like, we're thinking about that. I mean, we're thinking about what we can do to create more giving opportunities in the future. So every year we say, what haven't we thought of this year that we could try in the future? Examples of things that we are doing now to create better giving opportunities in the future. We provided a seed grant to a group that does conditional cash transfers, which is a different program from unconditional. It's basically things like paying parents on the basis that their children attend school and have their vaccinations and things like that. This is a good program. It has strong evidence base. There's no charity that focuses on it, but there's a very young, very new one that we're trying to, like, give them enough to get them off the ground. And we work with Good Ventures, and so for small grants like this, often Good Ventures puts forth that money. Another thing we're doing is we're saying, let's build the evidence base. Let's increase the number of programs that can say they're proven. So we've talked to all the groups that do, you know, good studies. We've talked to, you know, Innovations for Poverty Action and Poverty Action Lab and, you know, Evidence Action, which houses Deworm the World Initiative, and said, what can you do to run more studies, to prove more programs, and can we support that? And we did some of that too. So, I mean, it's something we think about, but I also think that we're in decent shape at the moment. So I think that's actually a pretty decent transition to just me talking about the standout charities, which are potential future top charities. So basically this year we had more capacity than we'd ever had before in terms of staff, and we looked at more charities than we ever had before, and none of the new ones quite made it into the top tier this year, but they could in the future. And there were some that really stood out and that had something outstanding about them, even if ultimately we wouldn't give there before we'd give to the top charities. So first, there's two groups that work on salt iodization. Basically, most of the countries in the world, and especially the rich countries, especially, you know, including the U.S., have public programs for putting iodine into salt to make sure that everyone gets enough iodine. This isn't something that's naturally there. It's kind of something that's always a publicly run program. There's good evidence, we think, that having enough iodine is important, and that supplementing iodine-deficient people with iodine can create cognitive benefits, like a few IQ points per person on average. Debatable whether that should count as an outcome, but we think there's at least a good argument that it should. And so we've been looking at groups that are interested in taking the rest of the world that doesn't have universal salt iodization and supporting them to try and get every country to that point. These are examples of groups that are much more advocacy-oriented, and they're much more technical assistance-oriented. So they don't go around putting iodine in, like, random salt. You know, they work with governments And they advise them and they advocate to them and they say, let's get a universal solidization program in place. That makes them hard to assess because they aren't doing it themselves. And so you have to kind of find cases where they made a difference and investigate them with more of a history methodology and less of a statistics methodology and ask what happened. And that's something we did with Deworm the World. And that's something we tried to do with these groups. One of them is GAIN. They're a really big group. They have been supported a lot by the Gates Foundation, though it's not entirely clear whether that support is going to be renewed, and we think they could use more. This year, we just weren't able to get to the bottom of their track record. We have some, you know, a few stories of how they've made an impact, but haven't been sold on any of them yet, and that may change next year when we do more investigation. So that's GAIN. There's another group which has a really difficult name. It's the International Council for the Control of Iodine Deficiency Disorders, Global Network, which they added Global Network on the end this year. So they're a really small group. They're basically, it's the same idea as GAIN. They try to do advocacy and technical assistance to get iodine and salt. And with them, it was more like we got their case studies and we tried to examine them and we just came away unconvinced. On the other hand, there's a really small group, like $500,000 a year, and Good Ventures has given them $350,000 this year, and maybe some people will give more. And so we're looking at a substantial increase in their capacity, in their budget, and maybe we'll come back in a year or two or five, and they'll have some real, you know, some real accomplishments in their track record. And even now, I think they're a place to consider giving. I mean, they are definitely a very reputable group, and other groups in the space talk highly of them. We just haven't gotten to the bottom of their track record yet. Another group is pretty interesting, Development Media International. They have the basic strategy of using radio and television to try to get people to adopt life-saving behaviors. Things like exclusive breastfeeding of infants, seeking treatment, early treatment for symptoms associated with fatal diseases. The theory here is that you can reach a lot of people for very little money when you're using radio and TV. And so if you can have an impact on their behaviors, you could actually save lives for less than ever before. These groups like this have been around for a while. This is the first one that is running a randomized controlled trial of their own program. And previous to that, there hadn't been any studies that we considered credible on this. This year, their midline results came out, which means they're halfway through the study. And they're hoping to look at the effect on mortality. They're hoping to say this program saved lives. They don't have that data yet. What they do have is self-reported behavior data. So they randomized who was in the areas that got the radio spots. And then they asked people, you know, when your child showed these symptoms, did you take them to the hospital? Things like that. And they did find some improvements, which is a good thing. Definitely, it's not conclusive. And our estimate says that based on the improvements they found and based on various adjustments we've made for not fully trusting the study, we don't think the cost per life saved is as good as AMF or our other top charities. It's also a newer organization. We don't think they have as impressive a track record as some of our other top charities. So we're not recommending them this year. However, if they hit their declared goal in terms of mortality impact next year, then they really could be, a lot lower cost per life saved than our other top charities. And so we've got a careful eye on them, and they could be a top charity next year. It really depends on what comes out of that study. Final standout organization is Living Goods. They recruit, train, and manage a network of community health promoters, basically people selling health and household goods door-to-door in Uganda and Kenya, and they provide basic health counseling. So they're basically running a network of door-to-door people trying to promote healthy behaviors, sell healthy goods. They also ran a randomized controlled trial of their own program, found an impressive drop in mortality. Cost per life saved, by our calculations, all things considered, is not as good as our top charities, but it's still really good. So I think they're a good place to give. And, you know, just on a note there, I mean, a couple years ago, I couldn't have named one charity that had done a randomized controlled trial that's like, you know, the most rigorous kind of study of its own program. Now I can name three. So I think, you know, in some sense, things are improving. I also think GiveWell's research capacity is improving a lot. This is definitely the most work we've ever done on top charities, the most charities we've investigated, the most information we've taken in. And this is the first year that I've done almost nothing on this front, because I've been focused on the Open Philanthropy Project, which is our other project that I'm going to talk about in the next session. So, you know, GiveWell used to really rely on Ellie and me and, you know, the small team that we had, and now we have a much bigger team. We're able to do much more, and I think that's a good reason for optimism. So that's been a long road getting there, and for a long time, it just looked like us with a very small team trying to figure out how to recruit and train and productively incorporate people into the process. And, you know, in many ways, it took years to get to the point where we're really seeing the effects. But now I think our capacity for spotting future top charities is better than it's ever been. And I think our top charities are about as good as they've ever been. So with that, I'll take about 10 more minutes of questions. And you can ask about standouts or GiveWell in general or the top charities, anything you want, except Open Philanthropy Project. That's next session. Yeah.
So when you think about the standouts for giving them money, how much benefit is there from giving them money now because you get more information or they're so young? How much closer does it get them to being a top charity than you give now?
Right.
As an investor.
Yeah, the question is, how much better can you, by giving money to a standout charity, do you increase the probability that they'll be a top charity in the future? You know, we thought about this. I don't think there's a really strong case for that in most of these cases. I think certainly with the really small one, ICCIDD, I think they need to grow. But I think already, like, Good Ventures gave them enough money to almost double their budget. So I'd like to see them get some more this year. But I don't know how much, like, more I want, you know, how much more really makes sense. Gain is more an issue of us doing the work to understand their track record. They're huge. And DMI is more a matter of, like, us waiting a year to see what that study says about mortality. So I think in all three of those cases, I don't really know that the case is there. Then there's Living Goods. I mean, I don't know that Living Goods has really got a path to being a top charity unless the other ones run out of room just because of our cost per life saved estimates, though that could change. Ian?
I want to talk about charities that participated in your process and didn't make it to be a top charity or a standout charity in terms of how many there are or the kinds of issues that you saw when you were talking about.
Sure. Do we want to talk about charities that participated in our process and didn't make it? Yeah, I mean, just one of the things that we've done is we've started focusing in only on charities that that are kind of focused on the programs we think are really strong. So we used to look at a lot of groups and then say the evidence isn't there. And we have, like, long lists of that on our website. Now we tend just to look at charities with, you know, with the most proven programs. And so a lot of it is a matter of, like, do they participate? Do they turn out to have good data? Another thing that happens is that we offer charities the option to pull out of our process kind of anonymously, like under the table, because we don't want it to be risky for a charity to go through our process. So a lot of times what will happen is we'll review someone and we'll say, this is what we think about you. This is what we would write if we reviewed you. Or we can just say, this charity declined to participate in our process. If you go to a charity page on our website and you see this charity declined to participate, it could mean that we sent them the initial email and they said no thanks, or it could mean that we went through the whole process and then they said no thanks. And we give them that option because we don't want it to be risky for them to deal with us. So we're not able to say a ton about those groups. I mean, I would say there's a general pattern in which we have definitely spoken to charities that we were interested in their program, and we didn't see any evidence of, like, you know, monitoring. How is the program going? Is it being delivered as intended? Or how are you going to use money? Or how have you used money? I mean, sometimes we've just gotten caught up on those things.
Can you comment on the number of these?
It really, again, it's like charities drop out at all different stages of the process and for all different reasons. So we have tried to produce these numbers in the past and put them out, and you'd have to, like, the more you define it, the smaller the number gets.
This year we only invited, I think, 6 or 7 to apply, and we picked those specifically and announced them on our blog. And two of those ended up on the standouts list, and 2 others we added at a later stage in the process. Gain, because we referred by ICCIDD, and Living Goods, because they came to us with their randomized controlled trial. So
it ended up being 9 or something, or no, 7? The total number of charities that either were invited or...
I think we invited 6 and then added 2 more, something like that.
And then we have 4 new standouts. Yep.
With the introduction of the self-idolization charities, it seems like that's sort of taking a little bit of a step away from strictly relying on RCT basis with charities. So can you see that's being taken further in the future, like relying on different methods of impact evaluation?
Sure. So are we moving away from randomized controlled trials and broadening out with the SALT itization? I mean, I would say we've never been wedded to randomized trials. There's different kinds of studies that we find convincing. And again, there's no formula to it. It's like for any given study, I'll tell you whether I think it's convincing and why, and it'll say on our website, like what kind of, we do have a blog post series on like generally what methodologies we find convincing, which we think are usually just not any good. So we've always been open to that. I think the iodine stuff was mostly like, it was like sort of randomized, the iodine studies, do you know?
I think it was a mix.
It was like somewhat, some of it was like arbitrary instead of randomized, which means like using the alphabet and things like that. And then I think there may have been some that weren't randomized that we found convincing anyway. And there's one study on worms that like plays into our thinking and is not randomized, that we think is like pretty interesting, and it's on our deworming page. So we've never been wedded to it. Then there's this fact that with an advocacy technical assistance organization, you have to do something that's more of a case study method of inquiry and less of a statistical method. So, you know, Deworm the World says, we played a key role in this program, and then we go around and talk to everyone who's involved and say, what exactly did Deworm the World do here? What would have happened without them? And then we come up with a conclusion. So the first time we ever tried doing that was last year, and we kept doing it this year with the SALT charities. Yep.
Do you think that the existence of GiveWell and the amount of money that's been moving the last couple of years has had a positive effect on whether charities are willing to actually collect this data and do these studies?
Yeah. Do we think the existence of GiveWell and the money moved has had an impact on charities' willingness to do these studies? It's hard to say. I mean, I think there's some reasons to think the answer might be yes. One is that we have seen just like the charity universe improving. A lot of our top charities or standout charities or promising charities, you know, didn't exist or were very young when we started. But it's hard to draw like very direct causal pathways. I think that there's been a growing interest in evidence generally. We're part of that. It's hard to say why different groups have chosen to run randomized controlled trials. I think the most direct impact we've had has been on the charities we've actually worked with, just, you know, making sure that they see it as really important to be, you know, the data stuff, the stuff about being transparent and open, producing kind of comprehensible reports about what they're doing and why they're doing it. I think that has remained a value for a lot of our top charities that it might not have, or the charities might just have gone away or stayed very small in the absence of GiveWell. So I think that's the most direct impact. And then, you know, I think the more diffuse thing is very hard to say. Yep.
Are there any charities you find particularly terrible? And if so, would you consider saying like a shameless charity?
Yeah. Have we thought about putting out a shame list of really terrible charities? We wrote a blog post a few years ago, which is not exactly what you're looking for, which is called Celebrated Charities That We Don't Recommend. If you Google that, you probably only get one result. And it's not a focus of ours, though. The way that I would put it is to establish that a charity is good takes a huge amount of work, and it's almost impossible to do without cooperation from the charity. Now, the way that we run things, it seems worth it to us because we put in a ton of work and then we give them a ton of money. To put in that kind of work with a charity that's not cooperating, just to establish that they're bad, just doesn't, you know, it doesn't, the cost benefit is not there. And that is something that is different about GiveWell from other groups, is we're not really interested in identifying the bad or distinguishing the bad from the average from the good. We're really just saying, where are the best? Where should you give? And, you know, we know you can win some media points for being negative. But, I mean, it isn't worth it to us. It just, like, the cost benefit is not there, like I said. The celebrated charities that we don't recommend post, I think, is kind of interesting. What we did there is we more looked at charities that are really renowned, that people really love, and kind of called into question the stories they're telling about themselves. And I think a lot of that stuff is worth reading and is interesting. And is actually more interesting than, you know, just hearing. If you want to know literally the worst charity in the world, it would be some operation that's a complete scam. And they would call you and ask you for money, and then they would illegally spend it on other things. And that's just not very interesting. Well, so.
No, because you could have a charity that has negative impact.
That goes and harms people.
Like plate bombs, right?
Right. I think Play Pumps is closer to neutral, but yeah, I think they had some negative impact. That is, yeah. Play Pumps is an interesting story. I guess I don't have time to tell it. Yep.
Are there any charities cases that you think are particularly underserved that you think would have potential to be top charities, standout charities?
Yeah. Are there spaces we think that are underserved, that someone who is doing something could be a top charity. I think we've thought about putting out kind of a request for, you know, a request for charities or something. And we might do that in the next year. And I think the answer is yes. We definitely have some ideas. A few years ago, we would have said cash transfers. Then along came GiveDirectly. Now we would say conditional cash transfers, where, you know, we've provided a seed grant to a group that's trying to do that. I think deworming, really. I mean, the two groups, Deworm the World, I think, has got a certain area where they work and a certain thing that they do. And then SCI, I mean, we've had our communication problems. Like, I would love to see a charity that ran more like GiveDirectly and was focused on deworming and that was going to all the places in the world where they're not already. And I think there's more. So, yeah, I mean, there's some answers to that. Yep.
So this is a question. I have malaria in mind, and you just kind of answered it quickly. Do you see a point in the reasonable future where, between charities and governments and overall the world getting better, where the malaria problem is not worth, it's not going to be a top charity because there's too many people distributing bed nets or
Yeah, do we see a point where malaria is no longer, there's no more, kind of no more room for funding in all of malaria, and so there's no point giving there? I hope that'll happen someday. I think there's a pretty good chance that'll happen. I think it'll happen for deworming first. Deworming's really cheap, and also the evidence for it is building, and the hype around it has been building. I hope and think it's possible that we'll basically be having deworming programs everywhere it makes sense in the world in some reasonable period of time, maybe a decade. I think that's something that may happen. Malaria, I think, will take longer. There's a lot of people to cover with bed nets, and bed nets are, you know, costlier than deworming, and so there's billions of dollars a year to be spent there. And
bed nets are only part of the... equation. You need treatments and diagnosis as well.
So I think malaria control is billions of dollars a year short of where I'd like to see it, and so it'll take a while to get there. But yeah, I mean, I hope with declining poverty, declining disease burdens, improving wealth, growing aid, that a lot of these things will go away, and that there won't be as good top charities anymore. I mean, that would make me happy for sure. I think GiveDirectly will be around for a while because you know, that's cash, and I think the room for that is pretty large. Yep.
I don't know if this is more of a question for both of you last week. But on your website, you had a couple of short posts about Ebola, and I think pointing to some of your previous posts saying giving in response to a current crisis, headline crisis, is often not a good thing in general. But it said that I think there was going to be an update. The last I looked on the website, there was no update.
Yep.
Do you have any thoughts on that that make sense in this session, or something for the other session?
It's in between the two sessions, which is kind of where we are time-wise. So Ebola. Yeah, I mean, we started looking at Ebola, and at the point where we decided that there wasn't anything urgent to do and we had to finish our top charities report, we put it off. We're now working on getting that post up. I think it'll still be a few weeks, but it'll go up. I think the Ebola situation is much tougher call than most headline situations. So in general, when there's something all over the news, I would say as a good general rule, you should not give there, because everyone is obsessed with it and everyone is trying to do something. And these things that get in the news tend to be very chaotic, which is related to why they're in the news. And so a lot of times it's like, we've seen it in Haiti and Japan. There was good evidence, good reason to believe that there was like more money sitting around than could be spent really effectively. And, you know, they're complicated, logistically difficult, challenging, unprecedented situations with a lot of attention and money going into them. I think that doesn't look as good as our top charities, which we think are largely working on some of the world's most neglected populations and problems. I think Ebola is a little bit different. It actually didn't get as much money, and hasn't been as kind of, you know, all over the headlines, I don't think, as like the Japan earthquake was, although it's definitely been all over the news. And it's also just the risk there is just so enormous. I mean, a natural disaster is one thing, but if Ebola became endemic or spread to a whole bunch of countries, it could cost, you know, a really ridiculous number of lives. So I think containing the epidemic is really, really important, and they haven't raised every dollar they're looking for. So that one has not been as obvious as some of the other cases, and for a while we were wondering if we were even going to say, yeah, give here, this is as good as our top charities. I think at this point, though, like, a lot of money has come in. One thing about Ebola is it is kind of a national security issue. And so rich countries tend to be more interested in it than they are in, say, malaria or, you know, schistosomiasis. So I mean, from the looks of things, I would say there is interesting work to do, but I think maybe the most interesting and good, I think maybe the most good work to be done has more to do with taking advantage of the interest in rebuilding health systems and surveillance to generally strengthen health systems and especially strengthen routine disease surveillance so we catch this thing early next time, which just would have been way more cost effective than responding to it on the fly. So I think that's stuff that we're actually actively looking into more under open philanthropy.
We should stop there. If people want to get more pizza and salad and drinks, use the restroom, and we'll get started on open philanthropy in about 10 minutes.
I'll pause the recording.